Well, it was just about a year ago when we were here, last year, when we heard about the 12 Thai boys who were miraculously survived from being in a cave for 2 weeks. And perhaps many of you heard that story, read it in the newspaper, saw it on TV, but I think it's really pretty amazing story. These were 12 boys and their soccer coach, and after playing soccer, they decided to go on sort of a initiation, a rite of passage, like a lot of young men like to do. And these were boys aged 11 to 16. So they were in Thailand and they rode their bikes to some caves, and they parked their bikes outside and they went into the caves and they wanted to write their names on a special part of the cave. So they went 4 kilometers back and 1.5 kilometers down. That's a long ways in a cave. And wrote their names. But what happened in the meantime was it was the monsoon season and heavy, heavy rains came and the caves were blocked with seawater and they couldn't get out. So eventually their parents, you know, got worried, saw the bikes where they were and realized what they had done. And of course they went to the police for help. They wanted their children out of there. It went up the upline, and the governor of Chiang Mai said, no, we can't go in. It's way too dangerous to try to save them. We don't even know if they're alive. So these boys were stuck. They had no food, no water. Actually, they existed by licking the caves because there was a little bit of moisture that came from that. They had no family, no comforts of home. And it captured the world's attention. And the world, of course, did not know whether they were dead or alive. But different people from divers, professional divers from all over the world came in. They came in from Japan, from China, from Laos, from Burma, from Australia, and actually even 30 came from America, 17 from our Air Force, and they were exploring the situation, and they decided it was too dangerous to go in. But then there was a Thai man who was a father of 3 children, and he really felt for those parents and those children. He said, I'm going in. So he went in. But unfortunately, he did not have enough oxygen to make it out, and he died. And they kept reevaluating the situation and exploring, because they had no idea exactly where these kids were. But finally, they did, actually, after 2 weeks of the kids being out without food and real natural water supplies or anything, they did capture the kids. They were sedated and taken out of there, and they all survived. And it was astonishing to the divers when they found the kids. They thought they would be completely, you know, lying just comatose or crying or whatever, but they weren't. Does anybody know what they were doing?
They were meditating.
Right. They were meditating. So it turns out that their soccer coach had been a Buddhist monk for 10 years. And as is the custom in Thailand, when his parents died when he was 12 years old, he was taken to the monastery because the monasteries operate as orphanages. So he spent the next 10 years of his life in this Thai monastery, and he became a monk, and he became very proficient at meditating. And it was only because after 10 years, his grandmother got sick, so he left the monastery and he went to become, to take care of her, and then he took up this job of being the assistant soccer coach. So he, Coach Aki, when he realized the situation they were in, he taught them first slow breathing, very slow breathing to conserve oxygen. He taught them very slow, simple exercises so that hopefully they could reduce a little stress. And he taught them mindfulness to manage their emotions. And after the, and every kid survived, and they were thoroughly checked out and hospitalized for a short time and sent home. And afterwards, they were so grateful that 11 out of the 12 kids went back to the monastery and stayed there for 9 days at the monastery because they were so grateful. And they even ordained. They did what's called a novice ordination, which young boys can do. And they did this because for gratitude and respect, because they knew this is what kept them alive. So all of us at times, and I'm sure sitting here in the past couple days, you probably, most of you have at times felt stuck, you felt trapped, you felt anxious, you felt scared, you didn't know what to do with all these difficult emotions, but we're lucky enough that we get to practice now in these amazing conditions. In fact, we don't want to wait till we're in extreme circumstances to start practicing. As John Kabat-Zinn, who's the person who created mindfulness-based stress reduction, says, don't wait till you have to jump out of an airplane to start weaving your parachute. So here, we're practicing really important skills that hopefully will not just serve us in times of trauma, but will actually just help us have better lives when we go back, because we'll make better choices. Now, so tonight I'm going to be talking about suffering and dealing with suffering. And suffering is the first noble truth. I mean, if you have a body, you are at times going to suffer. That's just the reality of things. And unless you die young, you will get old, you will get sick, you will die, and you will be separated from all that is near and dear to you. And in fact, the Buddha said it was important that we sort of meditate on those facts every day. Not to become grim or depressed, but just to really take that to heart and to appreciate what we do have now. We have so much in our lives, but sometimes we kind of overlook it, especially if we have sort of a tendency to be looking for what's going wrong. But there are really two kinds of suffering, and you're probably familiar with this teaching. There's the kind of suffering or pain that we will all experience. That's being separated from loved ones, losing a job, bad weather, pain in our bodies, whatever. Those kind of sufferings comes to everybody. But in addition, and that would be called in Buddhist teaching the first arrow. So we're all going to get stuck at times with arrows. But the second arrow is the one that we ourselves inflict on ourselves, that we add to the suffering by our mental attitudes about how we respond to it. And we start blaming ourselves or blaming other people or blaming whatever. And we resist our suffering. We have all sorts of ways that we can just increase our suffering by the way we respond to it. And so what we're practicing here is not resisting life, but in fact just turning towards our suffering and saying, well, what can I learn from this? Or what is my wisest response to handling this? And we're also practicing for developing equanimity or balance in our lives so we don't get so thrown off and stirred up when things go wrong. And the Buddha said, if it were not possible for you to become liberated, I would not teach you to do so. So he had tremendous faith that we all have that capacity to at least lighten up. Now, our level of happiness is conditioned by how we perceive what's going on and how we respond to what we perceive. And if we are always looking for what will go wrong and we see it happening and then we become angry and tense and blaming, we're not going to have very happy lives. But if we do this, a lot of it is not really our fault. A lot of it has to do with our conditioning. It's, in fact, a lot is genetically determined, and then there's all the years of parenting that we received, the culture we grew up in, the messages we heard in school, the beliefs we took on about who we are, even the food we eat, as we well know, influences how we feel. And so I think it's so exciting to live in this time because when I was going to graduate school in psychology, we really thought everybody was pretty well formed by the time they were 5 or 6. And the best we could do is teach people how to make the best of the cards they were dealt. And we're finding out so much more now and how it truly is possible to change. And to change at later stages. And they've always done research on college kids, basically. College kids are cheap and available. So they run all the studies on college kids. So we know 18-year-olds can change. But we really don't know what the capacities are of 40-year-olds and 50-year-olds. But there's a lot of belief now that people can keep changing their entire lives, that people in senior centers learn all sorts of new habits once they're really convinced that they can do it and have a lot of support for change. So I say that because sometimes we sort of get into that, oh, I was born with this lot and I've just got to be that way my whole life. And that really is being disproven every day. But truly happy people do feel everything. It's not that you'll leave this retreat and just go merrily singing off into your life and never feel pain again. That's ridiculous. Of course they do. And as the Taoists say, we feel the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. It's all part of life. But and when we come to retreats, sometimes our unfinished business catches up with us. It's stuff that we've been too busy to look at or we've been lucky enough to be distracted from. And all of a sudden we're sitting here with no distractions and boom, it comes up. So that's just part of, as I was talking about it yesterday, sort of cleaning out the refrigerator. Maybe there's some old rotten fruit down at the bottom of the heap there, and it's got to come up and it's got to be cleaned out. So I'm going to be talking tonight about some strategies for dealing with emotional difficulties that come up. And if you're noticing that you still have some habits that you wish you would have changed, actually that's good news. And the good news part of it is that you're noticing it. As Pema Chodron, a Tibetan teacher, says, take delight in that which is aware of the suffering. So it's not that you're so delighted by the suffering, but it's the awareness. If you weren't aware, you wouldn't be motivated to change. And so It seems that for some of us, most of us, to give up some of our bad habits, we really have to come in contact with how much suffering that costs us. Otherwise, it's just too easy to keep on eating the third candy bar or whatever it is in your case. So actually noticing your bad habits is liberating, because once you really feel them, and I would suggest that if you're noticing some habits that you want to let go of, really feel what the cost is to you emotionally and physically, and just get a sense of that, what the toll is. And then one of the major gifts of mindfulness is choice. Then you start to have more choice. And sometimes you don't catch the habit till way after you've done it. But still, you might cringe and you might say, ugh, I don't want to do that anymore. This is not the way I want to live. And that's actually good, because it shows that you're not that same person as you were when you did that. That now you have more insight and maybe more compassion, and you really don't want to put yourself through that. So while you're cringing, this is unpleasant, I'm remembering what I said to so-and-so, also notice really how that feels in your body, really how it feels emotionally, how shut down, how constricted that is. But you can make a choice and say, I'm going to do another way next time. And then as we get more along the path, we start catching ourselves in the middle of the habit. And again, we can make a choice right there. I'm about to, or I'm in the middle. Well, maybe I can apologize now to my child for, I spoke in a kind of rough, harsh way, but that's not the way I want to talk. So just to clear it up right then. And then as we get more and more along in that habit, we start to notice just when we're about to do it. And then we can turn the other way and say, no, I think I'll spare myself all that suffering. So there's lots of stages of it, but it all implies that we are the ones that have the choice once we have the awareness of whether we act or not. In fact, Viktor Frankl said, between the stimulus and the response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. So I want to talk about one of the habits that I've had for many years, probably most of my life, and that is worry. And neuroscience says that as a human species, we're always on the lookout for danger. In fact, you've probably heard the term that Rick Hansen coined, we are Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. We hold on to what can go wrong and does go wrong. And so worry is one of those things that many people have. And there's a story I'd like to tell you about a Sufi wise man and philosopher, Mullah Nasiruddin, of the 13th century. And he was found by one of his students. He was sprinkling breadcrumbs all around his house. And the student came along and said, Mullah, why are you sprinkling those breadcrumbs around your house? And he said, well, to keep away the tigers. And the student said, huh? There aren't tigers for hundreds of miles. And he says, effective, isn't it? So our minds will make up things to worry about, and then we'll make up strategies to deal with those worries. And they might not have anything to do with reality. In fact, Mark Twain, an American author, said, "I've been through some terrible things in my life, some of which actually happened." So one of the liberating things to realize, and I hope you do realize this, is that you don't have to figure it all out. It's a really simple statement, but it has profound implications. Because when we have nothing to distract ourselves, we think we have to figure out whatever. And the mind can go round and round. One time I was giving I was putting on a dinner party, and Joseph Goldstein, who's a teacher and a friend, was coming, and about 15 people were coming to dinner, and I was on the retreat, and right after the retreat, we were going to have the dinner party, and so my mind, I wasn't even trying this, but it kept coming up with recipes. I mean, I swear, I had about 10 different things, the whole menus planned. And then after I got out of the retreat, sure enough, I didn't do any of those. I did something totally different. So the mind does that. The mind comes up with stuff. And in fact, the positive is it can be super creative. But the creativity doesn't come from worry, believe me. The creativity seems to come when we sort of clear everything out, and then it can just bubble up. So you don't have to figure it out all right now. You just instead can turn the question toward yourself, what's true right now? You know, and really come back to your own body. Come back to your own breath. You might open your eyes. And another story that illustrates this is a young boy says to his mom, "Hey, Mom, imagine that you were surrounded by 10 fierce, hungry tigers. What would you do?" And the mom goes, "Well, gosh, I don't know. Ooh, 10 hungry, fierce tigers. I don't know. What should I do?" And the boy says, "Stop imagining." So, I'm a mom. I've had plenty of years of worrying. And one time our son Adam was working up in a place, Glacier National Park, which is actually a place I worked many years before when I was about his age, and I really encouraged him to go and work there. And he was 19, and he loves the outdoors, he loves nature, and like most 19-year-old boys at that time, he thought nothing bad really could happen to him. So we were, the three of us, James and I drove up to visit him, and we all went hiking, and we came to this place that there was this beautiful waterfall and a pool below, and there was a sign, and it said, "Do not jump over into the pool below." And so these two young guys came along, looked at the sign, took off some of their clothes, jumped over. And the next thing I know, my son takes off his clothes, jumps over. I go, "Oh my." And this woman comes over to me and says, "Wouldn't you hate to be there, Mom?" So I was like, so if I wasn't worried already, what was happening was after he left that job at the end of summer, he was going on a Buddhist studies abroad program in Bodh Gaya, India. And so he's going to be gone for 6 months. And I was kind of worried about the whole thing, I have to say. But I knew that after he studied for a long time, he was going to go hiking in the Himalayas. And I said, hey, Adam, I think you should get some hiking boots. You know, that's a good idea. And he said, I want to travel light. And I said, no, you really should get some hiking boots. And he said, oh, I'll buy them there. And I said, I've been to India. I doubt it. You know, not so easy. And he said, nah, I'm not taking them. So I gave up. So it wasn't so easy. This was a long time up, you know, this was like 13 years ago. So, we didn't have a lot of communication, but he did call me right before he was going to go hiking up in the hills, and I said, oh, well, by the way, did you ever get the hiking boots? And he said, oh, no, but I got my mantra. I said, okay, what's your mantra? And he said, my mantra is, let go, let's go. Okay, how reassuring. So then, you know, didn't have any communication for a long time. My girlfriend said, hey, let's go on this bird watching trip up in Sacramento. And so we did, and it was an overnight trip, and we went to these beautiful locations, amazing birds. And then I was sitting on this edge of a lake, and there was a woman close to me, and I didn't really know her, but she was on the trip, and she said, isn't this gorgeous? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I realized I wasn't even taking it in. I was thinking about my son, who I can do nothing about. And she said, and I told her a little bit about the story, and she said, oh, I know what you mean. Then she said, my son is in the army, and he's in Afghanistan. So every night and every morning when I go to sleep and every morning when I wake up, I say a prayer. And I say, grateful that he's alive, because I know the U.S. Army will tell me if he's not alive. So I thought, whoa, okay. If she can do that, I need some mental adjustment to handle my situation. So what I came up with, which really did work for me, is every time I started worrying about my son, I just instead did metta for him. And that's what you did this afternoon with Anne, metta. And I really recommend it. If you're worrying about someone and you really can't do anything for them, it's just better for yourself to say something like, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. And I got a lot of practice in that month, and he came home healthy and happy, and, you know, it all worked out. But whether he would have or not, I'm sure I enjoyed the month more by just doing metta instead of worrying. So that's one thing, worry. And I really say, you know, to try to follow those suggestions about not trying to figure it all out. And stop imagining if you can. Really turn yourself back to the present, because you're getting frozen in that loop. Also, just kind of remember common humanity. We all have struggles and suffering. We can't control everything. But to really try to ground yourself in what's happening right now. Now, another thing that comes up for us on our retreats is judging and comparing our practice. And one time I was on a six-week retreat, and I was a veggie chopper, and I really liked my team, and there was just such a great feeling. And people seemed sort of cheerful when we were chopping vegetables, and I was imagining that everyone was having these profound blissful retreats, except for me. And mine was actually pretty good, but it was just kind of breathing in, breathing out. Nothing, no fireworks. And it wasn't until the end of retreat that I found out, nope, they were dealing with all their demons and all that. They just didn't show it when they were veggie chopping. So I really recommend not trying to judge or compare your practice. You know, someone might be sitting longer than you or doing more whatever, but you don't have to, all you have to do is take Oscar Wilde's advice, which is be yourself, because everybody else is already taken. or the Dalai Lama's advice, and that is, if you're going to judge your practice, judge it in 7-year periods. So if you look back to right now and you look back where you were at in your life 7 years ago and you think that you're somewhat ahead of where you were, that's good enough. That really is truly good enough. So I want to teach you now a practice which I think is really helpful in dealing with emotions that come up. And yesterday I taught the self-compassion break, which I think is truly like the gold for, I think that could be used over and over again. And reminding you is just, it's mindfulness. This is suffering or ouch, this hurts or ugh, to, you know, whatever you say to yourself. And then reminding yourself that all beings suffer, that you're not alone, that, and then the third one is to turn towards yourself with some kind of soothing touch, if that works for you, and then telling yourself whatever you need to hear. Like, I don't need to be perfect. Good enough is good enough. Or, may I be kind to myself. May I accept myself, whatever it is that you need to hear. So that's the self-compassion break. But tonight I want to teach you RAIN, which many of you who've been on retreats have done before, but I want to review it because I think it's a really useful practice for dealing with difficult emotions. Just want to do a time check. Okay. So RAIN is an acronym, which means each, the word stands for a bunch of letters and each letter stands for something. So it's spelled R-A-I-N. And the R is for recognize. That means knowing what's going on, just recognizing it. Ugh, I'm feeling so disgusted or whatever. It's recognizing thoughts, feelings, behaviors. We recognize we're stuck. So as researchers at UCLA say, name it, you tame it. So the reason they say that is because there's a certain part of the brain that registers feelings and like fear, whatever is registered in the amygdala, but that's a more primitive part of the brain. And we all have the prefrontal cortex, which is sort of the CEO or the executive center in our brain. And that's the part of the brain we use when we name it. So when you're sad and you say, ah, sadness, it actually moves your brain, your functioning. You're going to a different part of the brain. And that can be a good thing because the prefrontal cortex is more of a calming part of the brain. So that's the R. It's just recognizing what's going on. That's mindfulness. That's knowing what's happening while it's happening. The second letter is A. And that stands for allow. Allow the experience to be there, just as it is. Now, it's tricky because we think, if I'm just mindful, it'll go away. Huh? 5 minutes and it hasn't gone away yet? Oh my God. You know? Well, that would be resistance. That's not really allowing. That's saying, I don't like this. I've already named you. I've allowed you. Now out of here. Right? And things don't happen on our timetable. So allowing is just saying yes to what's here. It's not saying, I love you, please stay forever. It's just saying, yep, this is what's going on. Okay, I'm here. Some people say, oh, and this too. And there's a story about the Buddha. Even the Buddha had his shadow, who was Mara, who's telling the Buddha, you can't do this, you're no good, what makes you think you can be enlightened? You know, just all the negative kind of things. And sometimes the Buddha would be giving a teaching and Mara was out there. He'd shown up. And he thought, oh no, Mara's here. Oh my God, maybe we should move to a new town. And the Buddha said, oh, come on, we moved to a new town. Mara will move to the town with us. We can't keep running from Mara. Instead of doing that, let's just invite Mara to have tea. And so that's what we're saying here. We try to get out of these things. We try to avoid the feelings we don't like, the ones we're not comfortable with. And the suggestion is, okay, let's just sit down and be together. Let's just allow this to happen. And Dana Falls, a poet, wrote this beautiful poem called Allow. So I hope that this will convey the sense of it to you. There's no controlling life. Try corralling a lightning bolt, containing a tornado. Dam a stream and it will create a new channel. Resist and the tide will sweep you off your feet. Allow, and grace will carry you to higher ground. The only safety lies in letting it all in. The wild and the weak, fear, fantasies, failures, and success. When loss rips off the doors of the heart, or sadness veils your vision with despair, practice becomes simply bearing the truth. And the choice to let go of your known way of being, the whole world is revealed to your new eyes. So that's the A, allow. So with RAIN, the first is R, recognize, then A, allow. The third one is investigate. Investigate with interest and care. What's happening right now? It's kind of like shining a light in a dark room. Instead of that continual habit that we all have of grasping for the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant, we're just turning on the light and saying, okay, what's here? And it's not a process of mentally digging or figuring it out. It's just a gentle, kind, patient approach to what am I really feeling? It helps a lot to drop out of the head into the body, scanning down, especially the areas that we tighten around. That could be, for me, it's I clench my jaw. James will say, hey, you're really angry, aren't you? Oh, no, I'm not. You know? Okay, so I clench my jaw. Some people, the throat. Some people, the heart or the chest. Some people, the belly. So just investigate in your body. Where are you holding on to? Because another saying is, feel it, you heal it. So you can't do too much about it if you're not willing to feel it. And we can get so lost, we can say, I'm angry, and get into the story. Well, he did this, and I should have done that. Well, next time I'm going to say this. And it goes round and round and round and round in the story, and you just get madder and madder. But if you really drop down and you feel into what the emotions feel like in your body, where are you holding on? Where are you tense? Can you soften a little bit? Can you just soften and allow it to be there instead of fighting it? And we weren't trained, most of us, as children, how to feel our emotions. We were more trained to, you know, just carry on and get the job done. But so this is a chance for your laboratory, just to be able to hopefully relax a little bit, sink into it, feel what's going on. Just check out, how am I experiencing this? And sometimes some beliefs will come up, because beliefs really run our lives. This doesn't mean that you should get into a big mental trip. It's more the creative response. You just realize, whew, I've been holding on to this belief that I have to do things perfectly or I'm not lovable. Or I've been holding on to this belief that I'll never be good enough. Or I'll hold on to this belief that life will never turn out. You know, any of those could be your beliefs. So they're very, very common beliefs for people. So I'm not saying that you start going into a mental digging treasure hunt here, but it's just be aware. If some belief sort of bubbles up, you can look at it and say, is that really true? Is that really true? And just notice it and just question it. Investigate it. And since then, so that's R is recognize, A is allow, I is investigate, and then there's N. And there's been sort of two takes on N. The first one originally, when this was made up, was not take it personally. Or you could say non-identification. In other words, you don't say, because I feel angry, I'm an angry person. That's identifying, that's making a solid reality, and none of us are that solid. You don't have to make a solid reality out of anything. So rather than I'm this, I'll always be that, just realize no emotion is you. So that's one side of it, not taking it personally and realizing everyone has these emotions. And then the other take on N is nourish. Nourish yourself with self-compassion, and that would be something like using your soothing touch, whatever it is. Some people sort of bathe themselves in some kind of warmth or warm light. Some people bring to mind their cat or their dog or their friend or their grandmother or whomever really loves them. But you can develop this for yourself by just asking yourself, what do I need right now? What is it I really need? So there's these, and Buddhism, it's talked about sometimes the two wings of a bird. There's the wing of wisdom and the wing of compassion. So in this process, the wing of wisdom is recognizing and investigating and not taking it personally. And the compassion is the allowing and the nurturing. So it's really all there. So now I'm going to guide you through a meditation using rain. So get comfortable. And you might pick a challenging situation that keeps coming up. You know, I'm the one that encourages you to pick about a 5 on the scale, but you do what you trust yourself, do what you can handle. So pick a situation, maybe repetitively it comes up and you're not quite clear on it. And raise your hand if you don't have anything yet to work on. Okay. So the first step is recognize. So just recognize what's happening. First, check in with your body. What are the sensations going on? Just recognize it. Just, it's kind of naming. Just name it, you tame it. It might be a feeling of fear, anger, anxiety. And the second step is allow, just allowing it to be there. As much as we want it to go away, we may be doing this so we can get rid of it. Just ask yourself, can I be with this? This too, this thing that keeps knocking at my door. So instead of trying to fix it or distract myself, can I just say yes, this too? You don't have to agree with it or like it or approve of it. You just have to be with it. Even the Buddha had to sit down and have tea with Mara. And the next, we've done the R for recognize, the A for allow. The third step is the I for investigate. How does it feel in your body? Where do you feel it the most? What does it feel like? And sometimes when we're right in the thick of it, there might be a belief there. It might be, check out, what story am I believing right now? Is it that I'm not lovable? I'm not worthy? I have to be perfect? And if there's no story, don't worry, don't make one up. Just leave it, let it be. That's fine. So now moving on to the N We've done the recognize, the allow, the investigate. The N is not taking it personally. You may be angry right now, but that doesn't make you an angry person. We all have moods that come and they go. Everyone has these. And the N also stands for nurturing. Can you bring a kindness to this? So if you were to use a physical touch, what physical touch would work for you, which would bring a little bit more oxytocin, a little more comfort and soothing? And what can you tell yourself that would be comforting? What do you need to hear right now? And perhaps you need to call in another being. You know, a grandmother, a friend, a partner, a pet, a spiritual being, someone that's comforting, someone to just be with you in this and not tell you you have to change yourself or fix yourself. Just stretch yourself a little bit in bringing extra kindness to yourself. And notice you may feel a little lighter, you may not. This isn't guaranteed to work in any specific amount of time, but it is a practice that's used all over the world in the Vipassana community because it seems to work well. So you can play with this, and remember, you could try it on the lighter things just to build up the habit. But notice right now if you are feeling a little lighter. And if all of a sudden you've sort of dropped a little bit any kind of story about there being something wrong with you, who are you without that story? Who would you be without that problem? So you want to keep this all in perspective. Everything is impermanent. We feel, all of us, everyone I know, including meditation teachers, certainly meditation teachers because they're open to it, go through periods of feeling really sad, distraught, and you need to keep that in balance. And be on the lookout for times of well-being and nourishing yourself. I was suggesting to someone today in one of the groups, and I'll suggest it to all of you, to balance your practice and sometimes go for what we call in mindful self-compassion a sense and savor walk. And that a good time to do it is after the talk, where you just go out and fall in love with the sun on the leaf, or the sparkle of the water, or a flower. You just go from thing to thing and see how many things can you fill yourself up with delight. That's fine too, as long as you're there and you're with it. That's mindfulness. It certainly does not have to be all grim. And so, balancing, you know, you can dip into things that are really keep coming up. You can use the rain practice or the self-compassion practice. And then there's other times when you're saying, I'm not going to do this right now. And you intentionally turn yourself away from the difficult subject. And you go do some exercise, or you do yoga, or you walk in nature. You do something that's healthy that you can be mindful with. So, one of the practices I love the most, which I spoke about last year, is gratitude. Really is a wonderful mindfulness practice, and it grounds us in the present. You have to, in order to be truly grateful, you have to be present for it. Otherwise, it just turns into some kind of, you know, shopping list or something. It's pretty robotic. But when you're really grateful for what's going on, it can be tremendously fulfilling and balancing to some of the emotional suffering that goes on. So, one of the ways that I use gratitude is when I get caught in one of those spin cycles, you know, like the washing machine that just keeps going spinning round and round and round and round, and I can't get out of it, and there's something going, and there's just what I would say, no new news, you know? I mean, I've already heard the story. I've already told myself the story over and over. It's getting really almost boring, but it just keeps going on. So that's when I sort of grab myself and say, okay, Jane, get it together. I want you to tell me 15 things you're grateful for right now. And I can remember being in the bathroom at Spirit Rock and saying that, because I was just like sick of this thing going on in my head. And I said, okay, I'm grateful that we have indoor plumbing. I'm grateful that the toilets work. I'm grateful that there's 4 toilets, so this line is moving pretty fast. I'm grateful that and I was really feeling it. I'm grateful that we have hot water and cold water. I'm grateful that we have soap. I went on, I'm grateful that we have, literally, I did this. I swear, at the end of the 15, I didn't remember what I was obsessing about, and I was grateful for that. So, hey, it works. I swear, it works. If you stop your, and I've had people, after I've told them to do that, I've had people tell me, yeah, I tried that and it worked. So, you know, if you get yourself into one of those loops and you can't stop, then you just turn your attention onto something else like that. So I want to tell you a story about a pickpocket. And this you know what a pickpocket is, So this pickpocket was hanging around the gem factory. And that's what he would do. He'd hang around, see who goes in, who goes out, and then he'd follow them and pick their pocket, steal their gem. So one day he's hanging around and he sees this very wealthy store owner, merchant, go in, and he says, I'm sure this guy got a great diamond. I'm gonna I'm going to get it. So the merchant goes on the train. So the pickpocket says, okay, I got to go on the train. Turned out to be a 3-day train ride. So this pickpocket tried every way they could think of to steal the diamond. Doing all sorts of things to steal the diamond, looking everywhere. And he had a lot of pride. I mean, he was the best in town. And you know, this was getting really frustrating that he could not steal the diamond. Looking everywhere for it. Trying this, trying that. Finally, they get to the destination. They get off. And he's completely frustrated. His, at least to himself, his reputation is ruined. And he goes to the diamond merchant. He confesses. He says, you know, I'm a pickpocket and I was trying to get the diamond. And, you know, what went on here? How come I didn't get that? What happened? And the merchant, the merchant said, well, I suspected you. So I put it in a place that you would never look, or I thought you would never look. That is, I put it in your pocket. And that's a story I think we can all take to heart. We came here and we're looking for the treasure. And we think, well, if I just sit a little longer, if I read more Dharma books, listen to more Dharma talks, do some more yoga poses, don't eat any sugar, on, you know, then maybe I'll get it. And what we lose track of is that the treasure is right inside each one of us. So I really hope that you take that to heart. Because all the rest of the looking out there will not give you the real satisfaction. The real satisfaction is discovering what's inside of you. And I hope that you'll try out some of these techniques that I told you, these self-compassion break, or just letting go of worry some, maybe turning to metta, using the rain, using the gratitude, and being creative for yourself, because there's no guarantees in life. We're all gonna be faced with difficulties. That comes with the package of being alive. But there are habits and ways of being that we can learn that will make our responses more appropriate and more nourishing for ourselves. So I want to close with a poem by Wu Min. 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. Thank you. So let's just sit for 2 minutes, just to...